rubbers?
It's the last.
That's not, hasn't moved.
It is, it'll be more time. All right, hi everyone. Good afternoon and welcome to today's session entitled Al Pi Gubi Mishichai, Recognizing and Addressing Child Abuse in the Jewish Community. Today we have the privilege and pleasure to hear from Rabbi Yonah Ries and Rabbi Mark Dratch. A couple words about them. Rabbi Ries, a noted Torah scholar, attorney and jurist, currently holds the dean position of Rabbi Yitzchak Hanan Theological Seminary of Yeshiva University. After graduating from Yeshiva College, he went on to receive a law degree from Yale University. He was ordained from Ritz, where he also earned the distinction of Yadin Yadin. Rabbi Ries also served as director of the Beit Din of America from 1998 to 2008. He's a frequent writer on a variety of topics relating to both Jewish and secular law. He is widely published in Jewish publications as well as in the Wall Street Journal and in the New York Law Journal. Rabbi Mark Dratch, an instructor of Jewish studies and philosophy in NYU, has extensive experience and expertise in issues of domestic violence, child abuse, and professional improprieties in the Jewish community. In 2005, Rabbi Dratch founded JSAFE, the Jewish Institution Supporting an Abuse-Free Environment, a nonprofit committed to affecting the way the Jewish community addresses all issues of abuse. Rabbi Dratch served as a congregational rabbi for 22 years, was the vice president of the Rabbinical Council of America, and chairman of its task force on rabbinic improprieties. He is a member of the Clergy Task Force on Abuse of Jewish Women International, and served as a member of the editorial board for the Journal of Religion and Abuse. And during summers, he is the camp rabbi of Moshe Bar.
Barashah. Barashah.
So don't go to
Moshe Bar. Barashah. Rabbi Dratch. Thank you very much. And congratulations to all the students who put this program together. It's absolutely amazing. And we're really extremely impressed, and it's a very worthwhile contribution to the community and to this very important issue and all the issues that are being brought up. Rabbi Ries and I are sharing the podium this morning, this afternoon, and our plan is to divide the presentation into three parts. Me, and first I'll speak on issues, defining the issues of abuse. Rabbi Ries will then speak about a couple of the halachic challenges of dealing with abuse in the Jewish community, and then we'll have about 10 or 15 minutes at the end for some discussion, questions, and answers. Okay, so that's what you have to look, forward to. The topic, the title that we gave this session is Al Tig Ubi Mishichai. Don't touch my Mishichim, my little messiahs. Right? Ubi Mi'ai Al Tareyu. And don't deal evilly with my prophets. Gemara says in a couple of places in identifying who are these Mashiachs and who are these prophets, that Al Tig Ubi Mishichai, says the Gemara in Shabbos, could be a test on the bays. Elu Tino Kosho Beis Rabban. This refers to school children. This refers to the little children. It would be I, I'll tell you, and don't deal bad evilly with my prophets, Elu Tamadei Chachamim. Refers to the scholars. And I think it's very interesting to point out, and very appropriate to point out, is if you look at the way that the Pasuk formulates itself, first come the Tinoko Shobes Rabban, first come the children, and then come the Tamadei Chachamim, then come the leadership, then come the scholars, then come the adults. And if we're talking about priority in terms of community action and community response, then children need to come first. Unfortunately, we see within our community and we see within other religious communities, the Catholic Church, for example, and others, that there's greater concern for institutions, there's greater concern for the clergy, there's greater concern for adults, and children are often sacrificed on the altar of community stereotypes, of reputations, and all kinds of things. And it's the way this pasuk seems to point out is first and foremost, al tigum shichai, we have a responsibility to children, and then everything else was about those children. Who, you know, what are we? What is our community? What is it really all about? And this is a very significant and important factor. And what I'd like to do is define for us what abuse is and how some of the issues present themselves and are raised. Generally speaking, when we speak about issues of child abuse, we're speaking about harming children in a number of different ways. What is probably most well known is physical abuse. So hitting, slapping, breaking bones, all kinds of things, causing physical harm to children, emotional abuse, and that's through the use of language, use of words, of undercutting someone's sense of self, their self-esteem, their sense of worth, in emotionally manipulative ways. There's neglect. Neglect refers to children who just aren't taken care of. They don't have proper shelter. They don't have proper clothing. They don't have proper food, proper medical care. Sexual abuse, which a child is molested and dealt with in a very inappropriate ways, and age-inappropriate ways, and with children who do not have consent. There can never be consent in that sense, full consent. That refers to sexual abuse. And within the context in which we're speaking, we call spiritual abuse. Spiritual abuse as well. When we don't take care of our children physically, when we don't take care of our children emotionally, then that's tantamount to spiritual abuse as well. Anecdotally, people that we've spoken to that deal with the issues of young people off the derech, that's a big topic in many circles, the suggestions are that some 80 to 90% of the kids who find themselves off the derech have histories of abuse. They've been victims. And if the parents, or the neighbors, or the rabbis, or the teachers, or the youth leader, or the siblings are involved in abusing children in one form or another, and or when they come to their parents or their teachers or their rabbis for help, and they don't get the help that they need, then it's the system, it's the Torah, it's HaKadosh Baruch Hu that seems to be abandoning them and re-victimizing them, and that plays itself out with many, not with all. There are many children who are very resilient, and despite difficulties they have and the problems that they face, wind up being healthy and are able to engage life in what we generally consider to be normal ways, and others are unable to do that. The consequences of abuse, physical harm, post-traumatic stress disorder is very, very high, very rampant in many of these kids, which leads to schoolwork, inability to function in school, and academics in many ways, inability to have careers. And many of them just flounder at one point or in one point or another. Inability to create healthy relationships with peers, with friends, in marriage, unhealthy sexual relationships, etc. And a significant number of victims of abuse themselves become abusers later on in their lives. Not all of them, but there is that is a significant factor. That's a significant factor as well. We don't have great numbers in most areas of abuse. We don't have great numbers in the larger community because most of this is underreported, and certainly within the Jewish community. Statistics suggest that 1 in 6 boys are abused sometime during their life, and the incidence is generally higher with girls, somewhere in 1 in 4, 1 in 5. 1 in 3 is for women in general. The CDC, the Centers for Disease Control of the United States government, says that sometime in their lifetime, one in three women in the United States is being abused. But that includes spousal abuse and other kinds of things as well. So I think the number is a little bit less. Interestingly, and again, it's anecdotal because we don't have great numbers in our community. Within the Frum community, it appears that the number of male victims is greater than the number of female victims, which is the opposite of the general community. Who are the abusers? You name it. It could be parents. It could be teachers. It could be rabbis. It could be youth leaders. It could be siblings. The rate of incest, it seems that in general, when it comes to child sexual abuse, that incest is the number one contributing factor with regard to these numbers. So it's across the board. Because we as a community like to see ourselves as Rachmanim Vaishanim and Gomlei Chasadim, because we have these stereotypes about ourselves that Jews don't drink and Jews don't use drugs and Jews don't abuse and Jews don't do so many things, we haven't always responded appropriately to these incidents. A lot of denial that's been involved, and therefore in many ways become co-perpetrators or enablers of this continue. And we have an obligation, whether the numbers are 1 in 4, 1 in 5, 1 in 6, 1 in 10, 1 in 100, 1 in 1,000, what number are we willing to settle for? How many children are we willing to sacrifice? How many children are we willing to ignore for all the, with all the other factors that we have? Even one is too many. And unfortunately, there are many, many more than just one. It's easy when we look as outsiders to other communities. So we can be very self-righteous when we open up a newspaper almost any day and read about the goings-on of the Catholic Church. I said, oh, how could they do such a thing? And how could they ignore it? And how could they send a pedophile priest to a different parish? And how could they turn their backs to these victims who are coming forward? We do the same thing. And there are too many stories to be told with regard to that as well. And therefore, I'm very grateful for this opportunity to speak about it here and to put this on the agenda of our community as well. So what I'd like to do is really speak about something that really should go without saying. We have to tell people they can't abuse children, but nevertheless, we have to tell people that they can't abuse children. Rav Schachter, I heard him say once that once a year in a shir, he stops in the middle of whatever Gemara is learning, and he says, it's also to steal. So obvious, he doesn't want an opportunity for one of his talmidim to come back involved in some kind of financial scandal down the road and said, my Rebbe never told me it was usher to steal. So sometimes you have to say what goes without saying just to make sure it goes without saying. But it's really not so obvious because children historically did not have rights. Children historically were not protected and were able to be beaten and abused and ignored and neglected by society, by their parents, by their teachers. And there was no recourse. So what happened in the general community in terms of interest in protecting children did not happen in New York State until 1875. And 1875 is modern history. It was the case of Mary Ellen Wilson, who was a 9-year-old who had been in foster care and went from family to family, and eventually winds up with a family that beat her on a regular basis and neglected her. And fortunately, she had a neighbor by the name of Etta Wheeler who couldn't put up with it anymore. It was like the movie, I'm mad as hell and I'm not gonna take it anymore. Mm-hmm. So finally somebody decided to do something. She approached a Jewish man by the name of Henry Berg, who was the founder of the American Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, to get help. Because you see, there were no laws on the books in 1874 that protected children, but there were laws on the books that protected animals. You could beat your daughter, you could beat your son, you couldn't beat your dog. And with the help of Henry Berg of the ASPCA, they brought suit in court that a young girl should be no worse, be treated no worse than a dog. And in fact, the court finally found in favor of this little girl. And that's why, originally, ASPCA was not just the Society of Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, but to animals and children. And that's how that came about. And from that, already within a year or two after that, the first child protective agency in the world was established here in New York State. And in the first year alone, 300 cases of child abuse were reported. And from there we have gone, and now we have laws in the books of mandated reporting for professionals who deal with children and other things, and Rabbi Reese will be speaking to that issue in a little while. So let me just very briefly share with you what I see as the halachic definitions of child abuse, and that becomes important because, unfortunately, to this very day, there are posts who will tell you that it is permissible to engage in some of these behaviors. And so, for example, are you allowed to hit a child? I don't know. We have sources which suggest that, right? Parents and teachers, those who were responsible for the education of their children, were permitted and or obligated to hit children, right? The famous pasuk in Mishlei, which was mistranslated, spare the rod, and spoil the child. The culture says you'll hate your by sparing the rod, you hate your child, but you mean, and if you hit him, the child's really, I love you. But spare the rod and spoil the child, an obligation to hit the children. So much so that the Mishnah says in Makos that if you hit too much and you happen to kill him accidentally, You don't go into Golos, you don't go to the Ir Mikvah, to the refuge city, because you were doing a mitzvah. This was then taken throughout the centuries. So the Vilna Gaon, for example, in his ethical will, tells his leaves to his family, make sure you hit our children so that they'll be trained properly. Rashi, according to Pasuk, says that there is an obligation every day to hit your children, whether they need it or not, in order to establish authority over the child. With Eliyahu Dessler, the Michtav Eliyahu, who is known for so many wonderful things in the world of Musar, writes that there is an obligation to hit children, that you should not listen to modern psychologists who tell you that hitting children just doesn't work, and it goes on to show that their perspective of child psychology and of human nature is so very different than that of Chazal, and there's an obligation to hit children, not to listen to the current psychological literature. And he writes, if you don't hit your children, then you'll be raising kitlaristim ktanim, little Nazis. And so you had this, this flow, this school of thought with regard to this as well. That being said, I think, and I have very little time, so we're going to have to cut to the chase on a number of things, and you're welcome to read this and go through many of the sources at your leisure. It was generally assumed, and here's a very important yesod. If you take a look at the second side, the second sheet, line 56. This is an interesting comment from Rav Hanan Wasserman, great Rosh Yeshiva, true word Europe, or the Gerard of Yeshiva, with a general principle with regard to all mitzvahs being adam l'chavero, all interpersonal obligations. So there's a prohibition against speaking lashon hara, and there's a prohibition against hating somebody, and there's a prohibition against taking revenge, and a prohibition against hitting, etc., etc. And he writes here in the middle of line 56, "V'lulei divrayim hagan yareh, dechol ha'isurin shebein adam l'chavero." Every prohibition between people, a non isurin. They're only prohibited if they have negative consequences. If there's negative consequences that have no reason and no purpose. Like not hating. The prohibition of hating is hating for no reason. But if hating will serve a positive purpose, I have to ask your local Orthodox rabbi, we're not passing in shahmas at the moment, then hating may not be usur. Hitting, causing physical harm to somebody, is prohibited. But if you have to get your appendix taken out, so I'm obligated to cut you and cause a chabura, to cause a wound and make you bleed, because there's a positive benefit. It's usur to speak lashon hara, but, right, if there's a toelus, if it's for a positive benefit, with a shidduch, or with a business deal, or exposing a perpetrator, an abuser, then there's an obligation to do so, and this is what was assumed to be with regard to physical discipline for children. That being said, the Sridei Eish that I quote here beginning on line 70 says that may have been true in a previous generation. Children today don't respond to corporal punishment. They don't respond to corporal, and therefore the obligation may be the exact opposite. Rabbi Lichtenstein, in the next line, in his eulogy for Rabbi Soloveitchik, respond to Rabbi Soloveitchik, interesting title, HaKaptan K'melamed. The Mishnah says in Pirkei Avos, Lo HaKaptan Melamed, that somebody who's too demanding and too particular with his students can't be a teacher. You have to be nice and sweet to them. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Zichron Livracha, who was great Rebbe to so many of us, was a Kaptan. He was of the stories, fortunate or unfortunate, by the time I was in the Rav Shir, he was mellow. But in the early days, he was a wild man. And nobody ate lunch before they went to Shir, because and the stories are, because he would yell at them and scream at them and call them names and all kinds of things. But Arn Lichtenstein says here, and this is, had he not said, line 76, this was the tradition that he received from his father and his grandfather, Shekayom v'vaday hayu ro'imotam u'bitzedek k'ma'asei alimut asurim, that today we would see them as prohibited acts of abuse. The way he says, Chas v'shalom, he didn't hit somebody physically, but the word he used as words today would be considered abusive. And in its time, in its place, and the students in those days maybe were more, justified or not, but it's an amazing comment. What Rav Aaron Lichtenstein makes the comment about, and this becomes important in line 80, Chazal dibru al kach, shetzarich shetehei smol docha, v'yamin mekaredet, that you have to have this ambivalent nature towards, with one hand you draw close, and the other hand you push aside. you're strict and you're forgiving, and this kind of thing. It says Rav Aaron Biyameinu, Chayavim Anu Lidog L'Kach Shegam Smol Mekareves Begam Yamin Mekareves. In our day, not like this. In our day, it's all love. It's always being Mekarev with both hands. Different generation, different attitudes, different applications, and that's what's going on. That's what's going on here. So when it comes to physical abuse, so even when we speak about corporal punishment being acceptable, I'm giving you a couple of sources to say that even today that's not acceptable, but certainly the kind of physical abuse that we're talking about, which serves no educational purpose, and it's purely as a form of power and control over a child, it's purely as a form of controlling a child, manipulating a child, undermining the safety and well-being of a child, there is no heter for that whatsoever, and it becomes usur. When it comes to sexual relations, it's important to say it. One of the famous cases, or infamous cases, that's been in the news in the last number of years was the case of Yehuda Kolko, who was a first and second grade Rebbe in Yeshivas Torah Tamima in Brooklyn. For 40 years, he was in the classroom sexually molesting young boys. Fortunately, for a number of reasons, and I had part, very proud that I had part in doing that, he's out of the classroom. The principal of the school reports, and some of the victims that I met reported, that 20 years ago, a Beis Din was convened because there had been complaints 20 years before. But that for 20 years, and even before that, in Camp Good, other things, that things were going on. One of the Gedolei Yerushalayim today, he's now a very old man, and I'll spare his name at the moment, although I probably should share it. One of the Gedolei Poskim was part of the Beis Din to see whether or not Kolko should continue in his classroom, and the psak was, pardon me, since there was no penetration, nothing prohibited took place, and for 20 more years, he was in the classroom of us. This is the nature of psak halacha in certain circles. Just very briefly, in terms of why that's not the case, it should seem so obvious, but it is not, right? That while penetration may be required in terms of the Beis Din actually punishing somebody, because the act has to be measurable in some way, it does not mean, number one, that the act was not prohibited. And there are many acts which we refer to as being intimate or licentious in some way that don't include penetration that are still lusser, right? So a boy and a girl holding hands with each other that are not married to each other. There's not penetration there, and yet it is still lusser. Other kinds of things as well. So it's just a misunderstanding, a misapplication, and sexual molestation is not intimate. But it's included in these kinds of behaviors. Engagement in any kind of prohibited, arousing sexual thoughts and ideas in oneself, or certainly in another one, and certainly in a child, is here or there, would certainly be prohibited, almost as a yahare yavor in certain cases. Emotional assault, and here I'll tie in the last part, because I have to finish at the moment, the prohibition of ona'as devari, of verbal abuse, using language that causes another person to feel bad about himself or herself, it undermines their sense of self, is an isur da'araisa. It is prohibited. And so whether I use language by calling somebody a name, or through my actions, even just by fondling another person, that has this negative emotional reaction, would be isur da'araisa based upon this idea as well. V'atorecha kamocha, don't do to others what you don't want to have them do to you, be a violation of that biblical prohibition. And beyond all of that, tzichul Hashem. Right? That when people behave, when rabbis behave, when members of the Jewish community who are representing God and His Torah and they're from and all kinds of things, and they're engaging in behaviors that cause people to raise their eyebrows, this is the way a Jew acts, this is the way a human being acts, that's a tzichul Hashem. And there's no avera worse than the tzichul Hashem, and there is no tshuva for tzichul Hashem in this world. That's how significant it is. So why this particular posek said there's no penetration, and therefore nothing usher took place, and therefore leave him in the classroom, is way beyond me.
I'm not a
great posek. That's something which is so obvious that it should go without saying. But as you see, things that go without saying, nevertheless, unfortunately, need to be said and must be said to remind us in the larger community of how we need to respond, how we need to act, how we need to restart our responsibility, Meshichai al-tareyu, al-tagiyu, not to touch, not to violate those little Meshichim. Who knows which one of those little boys or girls may one day grow up to be that Mashiach, and even if not, the rights that they have and deserve their share in their health, a life of health and a life of well-being. Thank you very much.
My name is Yona Reese. I'm the dean of the yeshiva, and in this capacity, I have been charged with a responsibility towards all of the students in the yeshiva. And I have become more sensitized, I believe, to questions of abuse of children in school settings in particular. We deal here primarily with older students who are college level and beyond, but the effects of what has happened to these children from an early age continue to be felt by them even as they continue their education and into their adult years. So this is a topic that's extremely relevant to all of us. I want to, like Rabbi Dratch, also compliment the students who arranged for this program today and for the opportunity to address these important issues. I also would refer all of you to the site that Rabbi Dratch actually has available on the internet. I think it's called jsafe.com, something like that, where there is actually a wealth of resources and materials and articles that help to amplify some of the points that were made in Rabbi Dratch's presentation. I would say that to the degree that we have a problem at all within our communities, it is something which I wouldn't trace to a particular Rebbe or particular personality or even necessarily a particular posek. I think that when we have these issues, it's really an indictment of all of us, and it's an indictment of the community as a whole, all members of the community, for not paying sufficient attention in ensuring that all of our educators exemplify the highest standards of purity and holiness in terms of the way in which they interact with children. In general, we sometimes focus too much upon other types of skill sets, whether it's in the realm of teaching, whether it's in the realm of kiruv or outreach or other important positions in our community. And it is important to recognize that the hallmark of a Torah education is an education of midos, of the development of character traits, of the development of pristine holiness. And therefore, we should really see to it that those whom we hire in all of these different fields should be exemplars of the finest character in every single respect, so that the questions that we're analyzing are not per se whether or not there's a penetration or other types of criteria, but are we hiring individuals of the highest, most refined character who go above and beyond the letter of the law in terms of how they interact with the students. And if we put our heads in the sand and we say, oh, well, there was some incident in Brooklyn or some incident somewhere else, but it doesn't really reflect the realities on the ground or the types of things that we should be worried about, then that would be on some level a violation of lo samar adam riecha, of standing idly by while the blood of others becomes a shed. If there's a problem at all, we need to recognize the problem can happen anywhere and it can affect anybody, and we all have to address it in whatever fashion we have that responsibility. Now, some of us, whether administrators or teachers, could be mandated reporters as a matter of secular law as well. If you find out that there is abuse which is taking place under your auspices, then you may have a legal responsibility to report that abuse. But even when there may not, technically speaking, be a legal responsibility, I guess that a fundamental point that I want to make is that we really have a halakhic responsibility. People forget that when the Gemara in Nedarim talks about the basis of why Torah teachers are allowed to be compensated at all for their efforts. After all, there is a principle that we have ma'ani b'chinam, afatem b'chinam, just as Moshe Rabbeinu was taught b'chinam, so he was taught free of charge, and he himself taught free of charge, so every Torah teacher really is supposed to teach Torah free of charge, so why do we charge at all? How can we charge money for teaching Torah? So one of the main reasons that's given in the Gemara is because our teachers are paid for schar shimur, for being babysitters, for watching over the physical welfare of their students. Well, if they're getting paid for watching over the physical welfare of their students, then how much more so is it a gross violation if they themselves violate and in some perverse way actually abuse physically the children that are subject to their charge. The Gemara in Baba Basra says that school teachers are musrin va'omdin, which means that they are considered to be perennially under warning that if they mess up one iota, even one time, they can be discharged without any prior warning. This is said in reference to school teachers who simply don't need to teach the Aleph Beis properly. And again, how much more so if they are violating their responsibility not to actually commit physical abuse of their children, and they're actually defiling their children in a blatant fashion. That type of individual has to be discharged immediately. Whatever is done criminally to such a person, there's no question that there is absolutely no place whatsoever, and there must be zero tolerance for such a person remaining in a position of responsibility towards young children, whether they're a teacher, whether they're an administrator, whether they are a camp counselor, whether they are a care professional, or whatever capacity. They simply cannot remain for one more second at that post, much less 40 years. Now, the next question becomes, to what degree is it in fact appropriate halakhically to utilize secular authorities when dealing with these types of personalities and problems? We do have an institution known as Bez Din. We do have rabbinical courts. Is it appropriate perhaps for the rabbinical courts to deal with all of these situations? So it's important to note that while there is some jurisdiction that the rabbinical courts have, and I served myself as the director of one of the largest rabbinical courts in the country, if not the largest such court, nonetheless, nowadays the main jurisdiction of rabbinical courts extends to what I would call civil jurisdiction. You deal with partnership disputes, you deal with loan disputes, you deal with real estate disputes, we deal as well with certain ritual matters such as gittin, we deal with divorce disputes, but to the degree that it involves the type of litigation that would be dealt with, say, in civil courts. When it comes to criminal jurisdiction, when it comes to having to punish murderers or people who should be put in jail, or where there's capital or corporal punishment that is appropriate for any type of offender, so this is more of a governmental function. And nowadays that we don't have a sovereignty in terms of running the government of this country, therefore the Batei Din do not enjoy criminal jurisdiction. So the question is, then, if the Batei Din do not enjoy criminal jurisdiction, is there an easy segue towards addressing these issues in the secular courts, or do we say that we have a separate problem? Because there is, after all, very strong language, you'll find this in Gemara and Rosh Hashanah, about somebody who's a Moser. If any of you heard of this concept of being a Moser, Mesira, it's probably familiar to some of you. Moser means you inform upon another person who's a member of the Jewish community, and you deliver them to the secular authorities. This was considered to be a very gross violation. According to the Gemara, a person who commits this act has no place in the world to come. That's pretty severe. We don't usually reserve that type of language for the most gross possible offenses. So the Tzitz Eliezer, Rabbi Eliezer Yehuda Waldenberg, in a teshuva responsum that he wrote, in the 19th volume of his responsa, addresses this question in the context of a teacher of small children who was sexually abusing the small children, and the question was whether to hand over this individual to the criminal authorities. So he said a couple of things. He said, first of all, when we speak about the prohibition of handing somebody over to the secular authorities, that's mostly in the context of an individual who didn't commit some terrible, a high-level offense, or at least, you know, as a matter of what the punishment according to Jewish law would be. So a person stole a little bit, so that's a bad thing to do, but it's not the sort of thing where a person would be flogged. It's not the sort of thing where a person would be put to death. And what would happen in these various countries is that somebody would be handed over for committing some other crime, a petty offense, or would be put to death, or they would end up having their house, home, and families taken away from them. It would be a much more disproportionate type of punishment in relationship to the offense that was committed. But if we're talking about sexually violating another individual, so this is the type of offense for which you are allowed in many situations, I'm not postulating on an individual case, but you're allowed to actually kill the perpetrator in order to prevent the person inflicting harm upon the victim. Certainly, you can inflict even as much physical harm as necessary to prevent them from committing the act in many, many circumstances. So therefore, if you're even allowed to go so far in order to protect the victim, certainly you'll be allowed to turn the individual over to the criminal authorities as well. Secondly, even if the case, for whatever reason, doesn't fall into that extreme category, says the Tzitzeliezer, when the earlier poskim were, and Gemara's as well, were talking about the prohibition of handing over an individual to the criminal authorities, they were mostly speaking about a type of government or type of governmental situation where there was no justice, where there was unfair discrimination between the way the Jews were treated and the way that other people were treated, or where individuals who had committed no crime, who just happened to have a lot of money, would be given over to the authorities, so the authorities would say, oh, so this person has a lot of money, we'll take all of the money. But when you're dealing with a just government and you're dealing with a just system of laws and of a criminal administration, so then there is no, according to the Tzitz Eliezer, quoting the Aruch HaShulchan, this is not a universally accepted shita, but the Aruch HaShulchan's view, which is endorsed by the Tzitz Eliezer, by Rabbi Waldenberg, is that in where you have a just country with a just system of laws, such as, for example, this one, then there would be no such a prohibition when it is necessary in order to turn somebody over to prevent harm to others. And furthermore, the Rambam, in his codification of the laws of Mesira, says that whenever you have an individual who is Metzer Sarabin, somebody who is afflicting harm upon the masses, who is a danger to the community as a whole. Like you have somebody who's a counterfeiter, is the example given, but how much more so? You have an individual who's a danger to the community because he's compromising the safety and the welfare of the school children who are in the schools. Then certainly, says the Rambam, when you're dealing with such an individual, they can be given over to the criminal authorities in order to protect the community at large. And as far as the concern that you sometimes hear articulated, what about Chil Hashem? What about the concern that it will cause a desecration of God's name if it becomes publicized in the community at large that there were certain offenders in our community, certain members of our community who were violating school children, who were committing these acts of abuse, would not give us a black eye? So to that, I would submit that we get a much bigger black eye if we're actually shielding these individuals and not turning them over and not keeping them away from our kids and keeping them away from our schools. And it is a much bigger kiddush Hashem when people see that we are very proactive when it comes to these issues and we really care about protecting our children. Now, there are the hard cases, and it's important just to register this note of caution because to some degree, this entire enterprise is a double-edged sword because on the one hand, there is a tremendous need and emphasis upon protecting the children. You need to protect the children at all costs. You know that somebody's an abuser, you need to get rid of that person immediately, eradicate their presence from our midst so that they don't harm the children. But what about the people who get accused but may not have actually committed a crime? This is a much more sensitive issue. How do you verify that, in fact, somebody is an abuser in order to know that steps need to be taken against that person? What if somebody simply has a spiteful agenda against an individual and raises accusations, and the accusations may not be true? So it's important not to have a lynch mob mentality either, that whenever a particular allegation is made, that the assumption is that it's true. But at the same time, we have to balance that against the need to protect the children. And this is a very difficult, iffy balance. So it's important to articulate just a couple of principles in connection with that. One principle is that to the extent that allegations may be made by the children themselves, and you'll say, well, these children are little kids, and how much ne'emanus, how much credibility can they have? According to Torah law, you have to be at least 13 years old. So the Ramah in the Shulchan Aruch Siman Lamed Dal and Choshen Mishpat points out, and this is very important, it's quoted by Rabbi Shaul Nathanson in a tshuva that he penned about 150 years ago, when it comes to matters where the only people who could have been in the room are people who would otherwise be disqualified from being witnesses, then we have to give them credibility because we have no choice. The only people who could have been in the room were the small children who were taken into some fellow's Bedouin when he took them on a camping trip or something like that, then the children have to be given credibility. They have to be given a higher level of credibility, at least in terms of a giving very serious probative weight to the testimony that they render about what occurred in their presence or what occurred to them directly. Well, Shaul Nathanson, going back 150 years ago, in case anybody thinks that we don't have precedent or that everybody is being insensitive to the issues, Shaul Nathanson, who was a Galicia posse, wrote in this Tshuva in 1860 about a teacher who was accused by various children of having assaulted them sexually, and various young boys who were in his responsibility. And the man, the teacher, when he heard about all these charges and when the community was beginning to get very agitated, he ran away to another community. And then the elders, or the heads of the other community, asked the first community what they knew about this individual. And some of the people who were the major personalities in the first community said, well, there were these charges, but they were never really substantiated. Therefore, even though it didn't work in our community, please feel free to hire him. And he was hired in the second community. And then some people from who knew what had happened approached Rav Shaul Nathanson to address this situation. And Rav Shaul Nathanson, in a very sharply worded response, said that you must take the allegation seriously. And even though he was already hired in the second community, you must get rid of him. And he said, how can I issue such a statement when the Gemara in Maseches Nida says, when it comes to Lashon Hara, the Gemara says, you're not allowed to believe Lashon Hara. But when it comes to Lashon Bat, it says you have to be worried about Lashon Hara. So he says you have to be worried. But he said, when it comes to being worried, that means that doesn't mean that you have the right to take punishment against somebody. It just means that maybe you don't hire somebody in the first place. So why, therefore, in this case, was he so severe? So he said the reason why he was so severe was because you had actual testimony. You had the children who actually came forward and testified against this individual, that he gave the testimony of the children so much weight that he was prepared to say that they should get rid of a teacher who was already hired based on this type of examination. But what a number of communities have done in order to make sure that is not rash action taken based on allegations that might be unfounded is to establish liaisons with the district attorney's office of their various jurisdictions. When I was at the Beis Din, I used to deal with a liaison who worked in the Brooklyn DA's office. Whenever there was an allegation, she would handle it, and her job was to interface with the accusers and with the community and with the law enforcement authorities in order to determine the credibility of the allegations and in order to determine what the appropriate measures should be, either on a very public scale or on a more private scale based on the situation, in order to ensure that the proper, carefully calibrated measures were taken in every single case. And what other communities have done in Los Angeles and Chicago and certain other places is to establish these communal Beis Din type infrastructures that are not Bat Din per se, but are these bodies, these communal bodies, consisting of rabbis, of social workers, of therapists, of lay leaders, respected educators, who whenever there is some sort of allegation that is advanced, they meet together and they consider all of the different ramifications and all of the different nuances of the case in order to determine which cases should be properly handled internally and which cases should be handled through criminal prosecution. But they coordinate with the law enforcement authorities, so the law enforcement authorities are aware of the allegations, and if there are steps that need to be taken, then the steps are immediately taken. And as far as the measures to be taken in the various schools, it's just very important that it be articulated clearly in every single school. I don't know how many of you actually work within a school setting, but it should be articulated very clearly by the administrators, the heads of the school, that students should be, first of all, made aware of these issues. There should be very careful and sensitive training sessions given to the students. And number two, that the students should be given a safety zone, that they know that if anything ever happens that's peculiar, and they should be told if something seems peculiar, then it really is peculiar. That's a good general rule. That if something is peculiar, they should have a safety zone to be able to report it, to know who to report it to, and to know that there will not be any consequences of a negative nature that will befall them by virtue of broadcasting the uncomfortable incidents that they themselves are reporting. And there has to be a very clear message, which is broadcast by the administrators and by the heads of every single school in every single setting where young children are taught, that they will not tolerate this type of behavior whatsoever, that there will be very strong action taken against any type of perpetrators, and that to the extent that anybody thinks or suspects that there might be any such action, that those people are are instructed to come forward and instructed regarding exactly how and how most effectively they can register their various concerns. This is really the message of the Talmud Yerushalmi. The Talmud Yerushalmi says regarding a rabbi who comes to town and the people in his community have to ask him a question on Shabbos that somebody is deathly ill, and they're not sure if they're allowed to violate Shabbos in order to save the person's life, and they go 2 miles to the rabbi's house in the middle of the night and knock on the rabbi's door and say, oh, is it permitted for me to violate Shabbos in order to save this individual? And by the time the rabbi gives the answer, of course it is, that they come back and the person may already have expired. So the Gemara says, Hanishal Meguna. If you have to be asked whether it's appropriate to take action, whether it's appropriate to involve the secular authorities, whether it's appropriate to report incidents that occur, that is Meguna. That is a shameful. That means that we're not doing our job properly. Somebody shouldn't even have to ask that question. It should be a given. It should be understood. It should be self-evident that if the Gemara says, Eina olam miskayem ela al hevel pihem shel tinoka shebeis rabban, that the world is only stands because of the words and the breaths of Kedusha Vitara, of holiness and purity that emanate from the mouths of our school children, that our first and foremost priority is to protect that holiness and purity and to make sure that we provide for completely abuse-free zones and environments for our children to the best of our ability. Thank you very much.
We have time for a couple of questions, so.
I attended a conference actually last Sunday evening regarding child abuse in the Orthodox community. It was held in Borough Park and involved mainly the Haredi community, but as well as the overall Jewish community as well. And the reporting of abuse was absolutely horrendous. You had people getting up there and actually relating the stories, how they were abused for years and years by rabbis, by principals, bus drivers, whatever the case is, and the cover-up was just overwhelming. And people, in fact, the perpetrators were protected to such an extent that anyone who actually were willing to report the abuse, that they were the ones who were ostracized, and they considered them to be the Chilul Hashem rather than the people who were continuing the abuse. Now, one of the points that was raised, and there was lawyers there as well, the fact that they're trying to enact laws in yeshivas similar to what in the public schools were, to force all teachers to be fingerprinted, to run background checks, and all staff who work in yeshivas, just as they do in public schools, to make sure children are protected. And apparently, there's a lot of opposition to enact these laws. And so a lot of the people in assembly would refuse to, for whatever reason, they won't enact it. Right now, it's optional, but they claim most yeshivas are not following this either. I'm just curious, even at YU or MTA, I mean, do you know whether these things are being done, or what would you recommend or suggest? Are you aware of that?
So I don't know what fingerprinting policies are currently in place, but I would say as follows, which is that if there is a law which is on the books with respect to the public schools, in terms of ensuring that all the children be adequately protected, then it seems appropriate that those same laws should be observed by our own internal school system, but I don't know the parameters of those laws as they currently exist. I do think that we need to have more thorough systems and mechanisms for ensuring that if a teacher is discharged from a particular position because they've engaged in inappropriate conduct, that this can be properly and efficiently communicated to all of the other schools within our school system so that a teacher can't simply go around from one school to another who's engaged in this type of abuse.
Just the JBAC, the Jewish Board of Advocates for Children, they have their own website as well. I'm involved with that organization that's been pushing for this legislation.
Right.
Until about 3 years ago, it was prohibited prohibited for private and parochial schools to do background checks on employees as an invasion of privacy. JBAC was successful in making it optional, discretionary, and now is trying to change that. There's tremendous opposition to that from the Catholic Church and from the Aguda. In terms of mandatory fingerprinting and in terms of mandatory reporting, which is different. Our children who go to our day schools and our yeshivas are not protected to the same degree that public school children are, and we have a long way to go. Fortunately, in Lakewood recently, because of the public pressure against reporting, and the person who had reported an incident was terribly harassed, there were files against somebody for witness tampering. It was the first time that we had this experience in a community against a religious community for that reason. Recently as well, there was a plea of guilty from some Amish leaders because the Amish elders had covered up lots of things and they recently pleaded guilty. So there's beginning to be a crack in the system, but the church and others have vested interests for all kinds of reasons.
Why is it good or against us?
What's interesting about the Amish case is that the court actually found them to be criminally culpable despite the fact that there was no clear religious hierarchy of who were the people who were clearly in charge of the community. Since they were the elders, even though it was an informal process to be appointed as the elders, if you are in fact in, whether it's a de jure or de facto, in a position where you would be the responsible party, then the court basically said that then criminally you become that responsible party. Yes?
What, if anything, is being done to these victims so that in terms of therapy, so that as they are adults, that they don't have flashbacks, they don't feel ashamed, that they don't abuse their own children?
There's two issues there. One is that they need help, and so that's a larger issue, how open we are in the Orthodox community to get mental appropriate therapy. Eliezer Schnell was in the faculty of Yeshiva College in the Department of Psychology, did a study recently. The findings were reported that in general, the Orthodox community is very far behind in terms of looking for help in these areas. So we need to make sure that that's okay. Number two, I think that we need to, the more we have conversations like this, the more we take the stigma away from dealing with issues of abuse, that we need to look at our shidduchim and the way we judge each other and judge others when it comes to matters of shidduchim or being members of the larger community, that if people feel stigmatized, they're afraid to come forward because what will happen in terms of reputation down the road. So there's a lot that needs to be done on many, many different levels. Run, don't walk to the locals and the nearest therapist and begin to get help.
Yeah, look, within this, our own institution, there's a counseling center which is provided for students who are struggling with all kinds of issues in their lives, and we try to push as much as possible for students to feel comfort level to share, things that happened in their life that continue to traumatize them and to hinder them in their ability to go forward and to provide whatever services those students need so that they can have a chance of succeeding. The best approach, of course, is preventing these incidents from occurring altogether, but once they have occurred and we have people within our community suffering from them, so we all have to do whatever we can in order to be sensitive to these individuals in order to address their needs, even on a monetary level. There's been a push, there's in the recent Journal of Yeshiva magazine, to provide within our Besdin infrastructure for cases to be brought by such individuals even years after the fact for monetary damages, for lifetime of therapy that might be necessary, or other direct damages that may have been incurred.
And the good thing to see the community is dealing with it responsibly, that goes a long way to healing as well.
I think we have to...
I'm sorry, I think I'm short. Yeah. Thank you all so much for coming. The third session, the plenary session, if you wish to join about suicide and depression, will be taking place in the fifth floor first, just like the morning. By Josh and Reese, thank you so much. I feel like I speak for everyone. It was informative and enlightening. So thank you for your time, your research, and for joining us. Thank you. Oh, thank you.